All right. Hello, everyone. I'm going to do my best to be really boring so Anne doesn't get distracted while driving. How's that sound? Good? actually, what I'm going to do, well, first of all, we're here for the Gutting Light. And during the Gutting Light, I am sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And tonight, we're beginning the very last chapter in the book called Aham and Aham Verdi. But before we do that, I'm going to play a song. This isn't a song that I specifically picked out because I know the lyrics and I think that they're fit. It's just as when I was picking a song, all of a sudden this came into my mind. It's a song that I probably have only heard once and haven't heard, 25 years. So I don't really know it that well. It's from Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And the name of the song is Go, Go, Joseph.
Joseph's luck was really out. His spirit and his fortune low. Alone he sat, alone he thought of happy times he used to know.
Hey, dreamer! Don't be so upset.
Hey, Joseph, you're not beaten yet.
Go, 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 Joseph, you know what they say. Hang on now, Joseph, you'll make it someday. Don't give up, Joseph, fight till you drop. We've read the book and you come out on top.
Now into Joseph's prison cell were flung two very frightened men.
We don't think that we will ever see the light of day again. Hey, Joseph, help us if you can. We've had dreams that we don't understand.
Both them were servants of Pharaoh the king.
One was a baker, a cook in his prime. One was a butler, the Jeeves of his time.
Tell me of your dreams, my friends, and I will tell you what they show. Though I cannot guarantee to get it right, I'll have a go.
First the butler trembling to the floor. Nervously he spoke of what he saw.
There I was standing in front of a vine. I picked some grapes and I crushed them to wine. I gave them to Pharaoh, who drank from my cup. I tried to interpret, but I had to give up. You will soon be free, my friend, so do not worry anymore. The king will let you out of here, your bundle as you did before.
Next, the baker rose to tell his dream, hoping it would have a similar theme.
There I was standing with baskets of bread. High in the sky, I saw birds overhead who flew to the baskets and ate every slice. Give me the message, like his would be nice.
Sad to say, your dream is not the kind of dream I'd like to get. Pharaoh has it in for you, your execution date is set. Don't rely on all I said I saw. It's just that I have not been wrong before.
Go, go, jump! 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 Go, go, jump!
You're
welcome.
Right. So I understood why that song was played. It fit with Gloria's teaching this morning. It was a summary for us. I don't know if you guys know the story of Joseph, but his father gave him this lovely coat called the Coat of Many Colors, and his 10 older brothers became jealous, and they threw him in a pit. They were going to leave him to die. But then some slave traders came along, and they ended up selling him to the slave traders, and he was taken to Egypt. And there he became a slave. And actually, he got along with his owner pretty well, and he was treated pretty well. But the problem is, I guess Joseph must have been very attractive, because his owner's wife fell in love with him. And his owner's wife, made passes at him, which Joseph turned down. And she became offended, and she went to her husband and said that Joseph raped her. She lied. The slave master, his owner, actually knew that that wasn't true in his heart. But, you know, his wife made such a fit that he felt like he had to, it was like he had to pick between his wife or a slave. And even though I think he actually loved Joseph, he picked his wife just out of duty. And Joseph was thrown in prison. So it was looking pretty bad for Joseph. You know, I mean, if you look at it from the worldly mind, look how many horrible things happened. His own brothers threw him in a pit to die, and then ended up selling him as a slave. And then his slave master, even though the slave master knew that he was falsely accused, threw him in prison. And of course, prison there was really, really awful. And it just looked like, life sucked big time. You know, everything's going wrong, you know, and all of that. And actually, everything was going right. And I won't tell the rest of the story, because maybe we'll watch one of the movies from Movie Group sometime. But everything was going right. And if Joseph hadn't gone to prison, wouldn't have met the baker and the butler, and he wouldn't have interpreted their dreams, and Pharaoh would not have become aware of him, and everything that followed, which included saving all of Israel from starvation, would not have occurred. So the moral of the story about Joseph and the multicolored coat, the moral of the story is, we are unable to judge good from bad, even though we think we are able to judge. We are unable to judge good from bad. As A Course in Miracles says, we don't know what's in our own best interests. And, in the song, there was the line a couple of times, it said, Joseph, you're doing well, right? Joseph, you're doing well. And that was even while it looked like he wasn't. And that's really the message of the song. You're always doing well. You're always doing well. And no matter how things look in form. And you just have to live from that trust that you're always doing well, that everything is always unfolding for your best interest, that you couldn't be anything but loved, right? And you have to let go of the mind's judgments about what's good and bad and what situations I want and don't want, and just trust that message. And this morning, Gloria talked about her car. I lost count. I think it was 3 or 4 times she took it in to get it fixed, paid a bunch of money, and then it broke again. You know, I mean, that's terrible. Maybe not as bad as being thrown in an ancient Egyptian prison, but, you know, I don't think Gloria's a rich woman. You know, I don't think she's a rich woman. I think that paying lots of money for her car and then having it not run is a burden, a big burden from the mind's point of view. It's a terrible thing. But we heard what a wonderful, first of all, she could not have given that sermon this morning if it wasn't for that experience. And it was a fabulous sermon. But she's using it perfectly for healing, and she understands how it's being used for healing. So only the mind would judge it as bad, right? When actually she is being perfectly loved, she's being given everything she needs, including a car that is taking a lot of money from her and still won't start, right? So that's the moral of that particular song. So it's kind of fun that we listen to that. So we're here for the spiritual teaching again of Ramana Maharshi. And like I said, we're beginning the last paragraph, the last chapter, which is Aham and Aham Verdi. And I have an interesting little story to tell you about this. But first, let me tell you what aham and aham verdi mean. Aham means I. And aham verdi is the I thought. And we'll find out as we move further into this chapter, but I think that when Ramana Maharshi said aham for I, it was like I am. It was beyond the ego, right? It was like the I am presence, aham. And then aham verdi is the ego. But the interesting story is there was a man, and I can't remember his name, I apologize. He lived in North Carolina, and he went to Tiruvannamalai frequently. He loved Ramana Maharshi, and he received guidance from within. This was after Ramana Maharshi's death. It wasn't that long ago, probably, when this guidance received, the last 15 years or so, maybe 20, but not that long ago. He received guidance from within to return to the United States and to start an organization called Aham. Well, he didn't know Sanskrit. He didn't know what Aham meant. And so let me show you what he did. I'm going to share my screen. This is his website, Aham, the USA Center. They also have one in Tiruvannamalai now. It is based on Ramana Maharshi's teachings. It's a great retreat center. But what he did, because he didn't know what Aham meant, he made up a name to fit it, the Association of Happiness for All Mankind. And you know, he went through all the paperwork to get this organ. This is him right here. Maybe we'll click on him in just a second. He went through all the paperwork to get a 501c3 under Association of Happiness for All Mankind. And sometime later, he found out what aham meant. And there's a moral to this story too, I think. And the moral to this story is to trust the guidance as it comes. You know, if the guidance tells you to start an organization called Aham, you start an organization called Aham. It doesn't matter if you understand what Aham is or not. So now it's just kind of funny, the Association of Happiness for All Mankind. But you'll notice that's down here in little letters. Up, you know, elsewhere you'll find that they're simply just known as Aham. In fact, they've even put the little accents on it. So they've come to realize what it is, Aham staff, Aham community, Aham retreat center. Now let's see if what... see if we can find out what his name was. No, that clicking on the picture isn't doing anything. Oh, he renamed himself A. Ramana. Let's see if it tells what his first name was before he became A. Ramana. If I don't, no, I'm not seeing anything here quickly, and I don't want to spend a lot of time looking around. So we'll just skip that. That's not important. But I just thought I would tell you that story too, because again, there's a moral to that story. And that's that if when you receive guidance, you follow the guidance, you know, completely, right? because the guidance knows what it's doing, even if you don't know what the guidance is doing. So aham and aham verdi. I'll start reading now. The devotee asks, how can any inquiry initiated by the ego reveal its own unreality? And I think I'll stop and talk about the question. Most people think of the ego as a part of the personality. Even in the world, this week I was talking to people who were talking about other egos in a very small town, and they were using the word ego. You know, they were talking about his ego and all of this, but when they were using the word ego, what they were referring to was actually fairly clear. They meant it to be self-image, you know, his self-image. He sees himself as, right? And they were talking about other people's egos and how and their self-image. And, you know, like if you studied A Course in Miracles, you might think of the ego as the wrong mind, and you might think of the right mind as the Holy Spirit. And that's good for a time. Don't get me wrong. That's really, really useful for a time. But there comes a time when you start to see the ego in a much broader sense. And believe it or not, even the right mind starts to become included in the ego. Because the ego is any sense of self at all, right? And if you pay any attention, even when you're receiving right-minded messages and you're following right-minded guidance, you still have a sense of self present. So it's still within that realm of ego. And in fact, some people talk about two deaths of the ego. Even the Bible mentions the second death. The first death of the ego being the death of the self-image, or what we often call the personal sense of self. And then you awaken to a expanded sense of self, which people often call consciousness. Look at this, we get someone else outside. Cindy, hi Cindy. Which people call consciousness, or sometimes unity consciousness. But the second death is the end of even that. Or another way of wording it is you wake up to the I am presence. And then there's the death of the I am presence, and you wake up to the absolute. So the reason I'm telling you all of this is because even our efforts to awaken, no matter how right-minded those efforts are, they're actually coming from the ego. You know, the absolute, if you just think of the absolute for a moment, the absolute doesn't need to make any efforts to awaken. The absolute doesn't have any desire to awaken, right? I mean, you know, that would be ridiculous. So, you know, when I sit down to meditate in the morning, that's really the ego that is meditating. If I practice self-inquiry, what sees this? What sees this? What sees this? You know, that's the ego. It's all within the realm of ego. And so this person has some of that, where this question is coming from. How can any inquiry initiated by the ego reveal its own unreality? You know, if it's the ego that wants to awaken, what good is that? If it's the ego that's saying, who am I? What am I? You know, what good is that? And I will tell you from my own experience, because I've had these types of questions too, as I came to understand a broader sense of what ego is. These questions just come from confusion. These questions maybe are what we could call an ego defense mechanism or an ego preservation strategy. Because if you allow the logic to settle in, well, it's just the ego meditating anyway, and then you don't meditate, right? You're staying in a more solid ego land instead of getting into that land that's a little thinner ego land, where ego can then disappear, right? So these kinds of questions, it's really just confusion that's meant to keep you from doing the practice. And yet at the same time, it's absolutely true that it's the ego that meditates. It's the ego that practices self-inquiry. And again, it makes perfect sense because the absolute wouldn't have to, right? So it's one of these things you really don't want to think about too much. Because if you start thinking about it, you're just going to lead yourself into confusion. So the question, how can any inquiry initiated by the ego reveal its own unreality? And Ramana says, the ego's phenomenal existence is transcended when you dive into the source where from arises the I thought. The ego's phenomenal existence is transcended when you dive into the source where from arises the I thought. So this doesn't really have to make sense. First of all, who would it make sense to? Let's start right there, right? It makes sense to the ego mind anyway. But what Ramana Maharshi is saying is, even though self-inquiry, like every other spiritual practice, comes from the ego, and it's the ego doing it, right? The mind. It comes from the mind, and it's the mind doing it. you are kind of going from what seems like a solid concrete ego world, right, to a thinner, thinner, thinner. That's why we describe it as getting more and more subtle. A thinner, 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 thinner ego perception. And when you go out into that really thin, thin ego perception space, this is where, and I think the miracle is a perfect word. This is where the miracle can more easily happen, where you pop out of the ego completely. Right? It's kind of like, let's say, this is kind of a sick analogy, but you'll understand it. Let's imagine that you wanted to physically drown, like this was your goal. If you wanted to physically drown, you're going to have to get off the beach, right? You know, you're going to have to get into the water. You know, you get into ankle deep water and then knee deep water and then waist deep and then chest deep and then neck deep. Now the drowning, you know, that's going to happen. You know, once you get out there far enough, it's going to happen. But you have to get out into the deep, deep water to drown. You can't drown if you stay on the beach. I'll just flip that around. You have to get out of the thick, thick ego world into the thin, thin ego space. And that just provides, I'll call it, a better opportunity for the ego to disappear, right? So it doesn't really matter. And let me just say one other thing about the analogy. You know, death is the goal when you want to drown, right? Death is the goal, but it's the living that walks into the ocean. Do you agree with that? Well, same thing here. It's the ego's death is the goal. Awakening is the goal, but it's the ego that walks into that thin ego space where it's more likely to actually happen. But yes, if anybody ever says it's just the ego doing the practice, yes, that's actually true. Okay, don't worry about that. It's actually true. So how can any inquiry initiated by the ego reveal its own unreality? The ego's phenomenal existence is transcended when you dive into the source where from arises the I thought. The devotee says, but is not the I thought only one of the three forms in which the ego manifests itself? Yoga Vashishta and other ancient texts describe the ego as having a threefold form. Ramana Maharshi might address what that threefold form is as we go into his answer. I don't know. But I will tell you what the Yoga Vashishta is. It's a book. Just like the Bible is a book. It's a book, the Yoga Vashishta. The Yoga Vashishta was not a person. However, there's a character in the book named Vashishta. And in English, that book is called The Supreme Yoga. So if you ever have any desire to get that book and read it, I bought it. I haven't read it yet. It's over there somewhere. Oh, no, there it is. I'll show you. There it is. Yeah, this is what it looks like. The Supreme Yoga, Yoga Vashishta. So if you ever want to read, a book with a lot of wisdom in it, this book is very, very famous in India. So they're saying this, So this devotee is saying in that book, it teaches that the ego has a threefold form and that the I thought is only a portion of the ego, which in a way, I said something similar a moment ago. I don't know what Ramana Maharshi will say about this, but I mentioned a while ago that people think of the ego usually as a part of the person, you know, like the self-image alone. Or the wrong-minded thoughts alone. When actually the ego is much, much more than that. In fact, it's even beyond the person. It's the subject-object consciousness itself, right? Which is much bigger than the person. So in a way, I kind of said the ego kind of has different forms, and the I thought isn't the only part of the ego. And that's why when the I thought ends, the personal sense ends, there's still another ego death, because really that was only a part of the ego. It wasn't the totality of the ego. But let's see what Ramana Maharshi says. So Yoga Vashishta and other ancient texts describe the ego as having a threefold form And of course, the I thought is only one of those three forms. Ramana Maharshi says, it is so. The ego is described as having three bodies, the gross, the subtle, and the casual, or casual. But that is only for the purposes of analytical exposition. If the method of inquiry were to depend on the ego's form, you may take it that any inquiry would become altogether impossible, because the forms the ego may assume are legion. Therefore, the purposes of self-inquiry, you have to proceed on the basis that the ego has but one form, namely that of the I thought. So I'm just going to talk about this paragraph in understanding based on how I practice, rather than, you know, getting into theology and trying to understand what he might actually be saying. In order to understand his answer fully, we might have to go ahead and read the Supreme Yoga, right? I'm not going to do that right now. But what I find when I'm practicing self-inquiry is that what I'm going to call the ego wants to identify with anything. So let's imagine for a moment that when I sit down to practice, I'm completely identified with the body. You know, I'm completely identified with the body. Let's say I have a pain that's causing me to be really identified with the body, a terrible back pain. Maybe I have a cold and a terrible back pain. You know, so the body's taking a lot of my attention. Maybe there was even the thought that I can't meditate, you know, because I have this cold and this back pain. Well, if that was the case, when I sat down, I would practice this, the inquiry on the cold and the back pain. You know, I would close my eyes, and maybe, you know, the cold would probably bother me more. I don't know about you, but because I'm imagining a head cold, because it's up here at the head, it would bother me more. So I would probably start with that because it's bothering me more. I feel stuffy. Maybe I have a sinus headache or something. And I got to be real careful here because my power of imagination is getting stronger. And when I just now said stuffy and sinus headache, I swear to you, I had a brief headache. So I got to be real careful not to pretend too hard. I'm going to make myself sick. So real light pretending going on here. Because I can just zero in and I can make it happen. So there's stuffiness and there's a headache. So I would close my eyes. Yeah, see, I can feel something starting. Isn't that funny? I would close my eyes and I would look right at it, right at the headache, right at the stuffiness. And I would actually just stare at it for, you know, maybe a couple of minutes. As I would notice it. I wouldn't think about it. I would notice it. I would notice, you know, headaches tend to dance around sometimes if you really watch them. So I'd watch it dancing around. I'd notice where its edges are. I'd notice where it moves to. Same thing with this. I'd notice what it feels like. It would probably even start to feel like a tingling as I watch it more. And I'd notice where it goes and what it feels like and where it ends. And, you know, I would pay close attention to it. And then once I felt like I had really examined it, I would ask, what sees this? You know, what sees this object that I just examined? What sees this? What am I? What am I, right? To turn my attention to awareness. And then if I needed to, I would do the same thing with the back pain. My guess is, as I practiced that with the head, the back pain would disappear on its own. Like I would probably forget all about the back pain. So if the identification was really strong with the body, I would practice self-inquiry with the body. Now let's imagine a different day and I have a problem. Let's imagine, you know, I have Gloria's situation going on. Let's imagine I've taken my car in four times. I've spent, you know, $2,500 on it and it still doesn't run and they don't know what's wrong with it. And I'm all worried about the money and worried about not having the transportation. I've got this big burden of thought in my head. And of course, when I sit down to close my eyes, if I'm really consumed by this problem, you know, that's still all going on. I'm trying to meditate and I'm back thinking about the car and thinking about the guy's attitude when he told me that he couldn't fix it and blah, 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 right? All that's going on in the mind. I wouldn't look at thought the same way I would look at the pain. And there's a reason for that. In my case, and maybe in yours too, I would be more likely to be drawn right back into believing the thought. So when I practice self-inquiry with thought, I don't practice it the same way I do with sensation. With sensation, what I'm doing is I'm noticing it's a limited object, right? And it's just an object and it has different feelings and I'm the one that's deciding it's a headache or whatever, but it's just sensations. With thought, what I would do, if I had a lot of problems, I would inquire into, I'm going to call them half thoughts. So let's say that there was a guy who was really rude to me in this whole ordeal. And as soon as the thought started coming in about him, you know, not having to be that mean, he didn't have to be that mean. There's a whole sentence there. He didn't have to be that mean. When he didn't comes, if I'm really being aware and subtle, I already know where the sentence is going. I don't have to finish it. You know, the energy of the sentence is right there and the he didn't. He didn't have to be that mean. So as soon as the he didn't come, I would say, what sees this? I practice inquiry on half sentences. I don't let the sentences complete themselves. If I don't let the sentences complete themselves, I can't be sucked into the story, right? And I already know where it's going because it's a thought. A thought is not just the words. It's an energy. And that energy is already there. So I already know where this thought is going. And so he didn't. What sees this? What's aware of this? What am I? You know, and then I focus on the self, and then maybe the next thought starts to weasel its way in, something else. But I don't have, and where this thought is going, but I don't have that much money, right? But I don't have. What sees this? And you watch me, if you're ever meditating with me and you don't have your eyes closed, if I have a busy mind, you'll even see me turn my head and look at it, right? I mean, it feels like the thought's coming in from here, I'll look. What sees this? You know, if I feel another thought coming in from here, what sees, I mean, I capture them before they finish themselves and I practice self-inquiry on them. So I'm not sitting there staring at the story for 2 or 3 minutes like I would stare at a sensation for 2 or 3 minutes. I'm cutting them off and asking, what sees this? I also want to say, because this is really important, I haven't heard anybody misunderstand me in a long time, but there was someone who used to misunderstand me every time I spoke, and he just came to mind, so I'll bring this up. When I say I cut them off, it's not a repressive action. It's not out of fear of hearing the thought. It's not out of fear that I'm bad because the thought is there and I'm not supposed to have thoughts or anything like that. It's out of knowing that the thought does not deserve my attention, right? Yeah, it's about not indulging the thought, Jacqueline says. And intention is really important. Even if you were to practice in the exact same way I just described, a thought comes in, you know, the first few words, and you're like, who sees this? If you were doing it out with the thought of, oh my God, I'm not supposed to have thoughts in my mind, it's not going to have the same effect. Because then it's a repressive action, right? In fact, what you're doing is you're actually entertaining another whole thought that happened really quick. I'm not supposed to have thoughts in my mind as you're cutting off that thought. Does that make sense? So the intention is really important. You're doing this because these thoughts do not deserve attention. These thoughts do not deserve to live. This is just a story. I am not going to feed them my attention, right? That's the intention. And so you're cutting them off. You're not letting them live because they don't deserve to live. Not because you're afraid of them. So there we talked about, you know, we could call it two different forms of the ego, the body, the mind, and I practice self-inquiry on both of those, right? Another form of the ego When you practice self-inquiry and you've been practicing it, I'm going to use the word well, if you'll pardon the judgment word. Sometimes speaking is hard. So when you're practicing self-inquiry and you've been practicing it well, you get to these really subtle spaces within. And in fact, some people even mistake these subtle spaces for having popped beyond the ego completely. When they haven't, they're actually just in thin ego land, right? It's thin ego. Let's imagine there's this wonderful peace and this feeling of incredible spaciousness. You know, this is a place where a lot of people might think they have transcended the ego. Oh, what was it I heard the other day? The Buddhists call this hell. Okay, so obviously you haven't transcended the ego, or they wouldn't call this beautiful, spacious peace hell. It's the realm of the devil, you know, the ego. But, you know, you get into this beautiful spaciousness, this wonderful peace. You feel very relaxed, very wide-eyed and clear. But if you think that spaciousness, that peace is it, you're not leaving thin ego land. So what do you do when you're in that thin space of ego? And it seems so spacious and so open and so peaceful. You say, what sees this? What am I? Same self-inquiry, you know? So it really doesn't matter whether you're in this physical pain, mental storm, or a thin ego so much that people even mistake it for not ego. The self-inquiry is exactly the same. You just keep asking, what sees this? Who am I? Yeah, Jay says his mind seems to want to be satisfied with that. I think that's true of a lot of people. A lot of people, I think, get to that space and think that they have reached somewhere. And again, it's a thin ego space rather than a thick ego space. But the Buddhists call it hell, so that gives you a pretty good idea that you haven't left yet. So keep practicing self-inquiry. I wish I could remember where I saw that. That was pretty cool, that little article I read recently where they called that hell. But in this second, I can't remember what I was reading. I think actually it was the Enlightenment Intensive book, Jacqueline. I bet you'll run across it. I think that's what I was reading. It was in there. They talked about it. They were talking about how in the Enlightenment Intensives, in the dyads, people will reach that space. And you need to encourage them to continue asking the question, right? And it said that space is what the Buddhists call hell. Yeah. So, the next question. Again, we're talking about self-inquiry, and no matter what the form of the ego, you practice self, you continue to practice the same inquiry. See it all as the I thought. You know, and again, and he's very clearly saying, therefore, for the purposes of self-inquiry, you have to proceed on the basis that the ego has but one form, namely that of I thought, right? When you're in that thin ego space, which the Buddhists call hell, which is spaciousness, peace, right? Open spaciousness, peace. You feel like you're beyond the I thought. There's no chatter going on in the mind. And Ramana Maharshi is saying, still see that as the I thought. Right? Still see that as the I thought. So you can see that he's saying what I said as I began, that the ego is much broader than most people define it. So again, he just now said, you know, see everything as the I thought. And so the devotee says, but it may prove inadequate for realizing enlightenment. He thinks if I see everything as the I thought, that's just not good enough. Ramana says, self-inquiry by following the clue of I thought is just like the dog tracing its master by his scent. The master may be at some distant unknown place, but that does not at all stand in the way of the dog's tracing him. The master's scent is an infallible clue for the animal and nothing else, such as the clothes he wears or his build and stature counts. Nothing else counts, right? To that scent, the dog holds on undistractedly while searching for him. And finally, it succeeds in tracing him. I think the way that I word this when I'm teaching the same thing is, as long as you can see anything, keep asking what sees this, right? As long as you can sense anything. And if there's an I, maybe not even, it doesn't even feel like ego I anymore, but there's an I, there's a subject that's aware of this silent spaciousness, aware of this peace, there's still an I there. Do you see? So you got to keep going. I saw on the news the other night, this really cute black lab, very cute because I love dogs, very cute black lab, but he was trained to find people buried in an avalanche. And I think it's amazing. I don't know how people teach dogs this thing, but you know, like every person, as you know, has their own scent, especially to a dog. But when a dog is looking for people buried by an avalanche, you know, he doesn't know who was skiing and was buried by the avalanche. He's, you know, they don't have a sock from that guy to say, here, smell, let's go find that guy. You know, so they can't give him that specific scent. So they have somehow trained this dog just to look for the scent of human. Just the scent of human arising from the snow. And so this dog isn't even looking for a particular human. He's just looking for a human. And they showed he loves his job. Boy, his tail's wagging. He's running around sniffing. And sure enough, he'd find human and dig in and get to the human, right? Well, it's sort of the same thing that Ramanam is saying. You know, we could say the chattering eye, right? The eye that was worried about the car and the money and all of that. That's like the scent of a specific human. And that's only going to get me so far. You know, if this dog was only looking for a specific human, there'd be other humans that could be buried in the avalanche that he'd miss, right? That's only going to get me so far. So I need to be trained kind of like this dog is, where I'm just looking for anything and there's the sense of I am aware. As long as there is an I that's aware, I keep trying to go beyond it. You see? So it's way beyond the chattering mind, maybe. It's way beyond the thought of I'm Regina, maybe. It's much, much, much more subtle. But I have to keep going, or I'm not going to pop through, just like that dog's not going to find whoever's lost in the avalanche unless he's looking for a very general sense of human, right? We need to be looking for a very general sense of a subject, of an I. So again, it's beyond what we may call the I thought most typically. But Ramana is saying, keep going, right? Keep going. Devotee says, what time is it, by the way? Okay. The devotee says, the question still remains, why the quest for the source of the I thought as distinguish from other, I'm going to guess that word is thoughts, but I don't know. Let's look it up. Yeah, mental concepts. So the question still remains, why the quest for the source of the I thought as distinguished from other mental concepts should be considered the direct means to self-realization. So why is it this I that I'm looking for instead of you, right? Instead of the I am bad thought instead of, you know, the I am unsafe thought. You know, why is it the I thought that I'm going after? And Ramana says, the word aham is itself very suggestive. The two letters of the word, namely ah and ha, are the first and the last letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. The suggestion intended to be conveyed by the word is that it comprises all. How? Because aham signifies existence itself. And I mentioned to you that I thought aham was more like the I am sense, right, than what we tend to call the I thought, more like the I am sense. And I think that Nisargadatta Maharaj is much more clear in the way that he teaches this than Ramana, even though I adore Ramana. I wear Ramana around my neck. I don't wear Nisargadatta around my neck. But I think Nisargadatta is actually much more clear, maybe because he was a simpler soul and he spoke with simpler language. But you know what Nisargadatta says is find the I am, which is going to be beyond the chatter, right? The chatter, most of us call the chatter, and the I thought is the, you know, the beginning of the chatter and into the chatter. That's the I thought typically. The I am is prior to that. So Nisargadatta says, find the I am presence, and then stay there, follow the I am presence, and it will take you beyond, right? And that's really what Ramana Maharshi is teaching here. He says the aham is existence itself. Existence here, because, you know, all these words can be used in more than one place. Existence here is the sense of a I presence. Right, a presence, like I said, a subject. What sees this open, peaceful spaciousness? Something sees it, right? I need to get beyond this. I need to get beyond this subject. And so, again, he says that this existence is the beginning, or it comprises the everything, this sense of presence. And in fact, we don't even have to believe Ramana Maharshi. We can actually prove this for ourselves if we aren't too stubborn. You can always be stubborn, right, if you want to. But if you don't want to be stubborn, you can prove this to yourself. Just look at anything right now. And then if your existence wasn't here, could you see that thing? Right? No. It's just impossible. The existence is the foundation of everything, right? And so that's what Ramana is saying. He's saying that the existence comprises everything. If it wasn't for the existence first, nothing else could arise. Nothing else could appear. Nothing else could be experienced. So what you're really going after is the existence itself, or the sense of a presence. And this, by the way, might as well just be honest. This is why in the ego death there's fear, right? It's not so much that we fear letting go of chatter, although we do. Don't get me wrong, we do. You know, when people have problems, they think if their mind isn't thinking, the problem isn't going to be solved. And there's a fear. If somebody says, just stop thinking, just let things unfold, that's scary, right? Because I lose my sense of control. But that fear is minimal compared to the fear of letting go of the sense of existence itself. In fact, I think this is a good time, although we're in the middle of an answer and I'll have to come back to this answer. I think this is a good time for us to go listen to Dr. David Hawkins again. So let me share my screen. I'm going to share the whole screen because it's hard to search for things when I'm sharing that little box. So y'all will just see everything. Let's just listen very carefully to what Dr. David Hawkins says in this short little video. Which one do I want? I want to take this one.
So you become devoted to the discernment of this quality of silence within by the letting go of everything that stands in his way. The mind becomes progressively silent. And then there comes a moment where the only thing left is you. The only thing left to be surrendered is the sense of self, which you've always identified as self, and you realize that you have to surrender that also. At the final doorway to enlightenment, then, stands death. Death as you understand it. Death as you have experienced it. Death as it is believed in. Because if that which you think you are is life itself, to surrender that to God means to die. And at that point, the training you had as a warrior in many a lifetime, the willingness to die for a greater cause, now comes forth. To have been able to commit Hare Kari, the willingness to die for one's belief. And then comes the great terror of death, because all the times you've died in previous lifetimes was a joke. Whammo, you're out of body and life is better than it was before, I'll tell you. So you've never experienced death. Nobody has experienced death. This is the one and only time you can actually die. There's the knowingness that what you are facing is absolute death. And then arises the terror of nothingness. If that which I believe in, am committed to as myself, if I surrender that, I will become nothing. There is the fear of death and the fear of the void. At that point, those who have been through there, the energy of those who have been through that point will come to you, and you will remember. Walk straight ahead no matter what, no matter how severe the fear. The greatest fear of all, walk through it. And so the terror lasts for an ungodly minute. And one has made it through. So the great beings that have walked through there, and when you're there, you'll see who was there. You know who was there and who turned back. The majority turned back, 85% turned back. Therefore, I want to make the instruction clear. In thy name, O Lord, at the moment of death, die for God and walk through the fear. And then stands the glory unfolding. A radiance so magnificent, so beyond all comprehension. Beyond that which is humanly knowable. Because at that point you stop being human. You walk beyond humanness itself. In the presence of divinity. There is one basic saying in Zen that one can rely on completely. And that is to walk through all fear no matter what. Walk through all fear committed to spiritual truth no matter what. First of all, make sure that's spiritual truth. Secondly, make sure that you know this from the knowingness of that which has accomplished it. It better be a teacher who has been there. Know it with a concrete faith that that within you, which is dedicated to reaching God, is what's brought you to the point of death. And at that time, then, one says, for thee, O Lord God, do I lay down my life. So, Lazarus will be with you. Amen. Thank you.
So again, we're talking about letting go of much more than the chattering mind, right? We're talking about letting go of the sense of existence itself. The sense of existence itself. And that is what the aham is, or that is what the I am is. Again, lots of people think when they've awoken to the I am, where there's just this sense of presence, that they've awoken. But you awaken, you got to awaken from the sense of presence, right? You got to go beyond the I am, beyond the aham, right? So I'll just read this paragraph again, and then next week we'll look, because there's two more paragraphs to this particular answer. So we'll just start over with this paragraph again next week. The word aham is very suggestive. The two letters of the word, namely ah and ha, apparently ha is a letter in Sanskrit, H-A. The two letters of the word, namely ah and ha, are the first and the last letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. The suggestion intended to be conveyed by the word is that it comprises all. How? Because aham signifies existence itself. Existence itself. And you heard Dr. David Hawkins talk about that. He called it life. So, you know, we think we identify with, like here, you know, I would say I identify with Regina. I'm letting go of the idea that I'm Regina. That's only, if we call that an ego death, that's only the first ego death. Letting go of the idea that I am Regina is the first ego death. Now I'm just this presence. True awakening is letting go of the presence, right? And self-inquiry works all the way. It doesn't just work on the first part. It works all the way. It doesn't matter what you're identified with. You could be identified with the body. You could be identified with the mind. You could be identified with the presence itself and nothing else. Everything else has ended. As he said, there's just a silence. Everything else has ended. The only thing left is the presence. And you continue the self-inquiry until you transcend the presence, till you know what is beyond presence. All right, that's it for tonight. Thank you for joining with me, y'all. Bye.